You're listening to the Wesley Seminary Podcast. Your host today is Dr. Aaron Perry, Associate Professor of Pastoral Theology and Leadership.
What does it mean to be a leader in an increasingly secular context? The other day I was thinking about there are some people who see secularism as their enemy, and there are some people who see secularism as their context. And here's the thing, they both might be right. Secularism might be an enemy, and secularism might be a context. And sometimes it takes some effort to parse that out. Beyond that, what does it mean to lead in a secular age? What does it mean to lead a church that's bound up in a secular age and that's caught in one as well? Those are the questions that were being asked by Dr. Gordon Smith. Dr. Smith is the president of Ambrose University and Seminary in Calgary, Alberta. He also serves as professor of systematic and spiritual theology. He's an ordained minister in the Christian and Missionary Alliance, and he's author of Wisdom from Babylon, Leadership for the Church in a Secular Age. In today's podcast, we're going to talk about leadership in the secular age. We're going to define what secularism is and some ways that people might be wrestling through that. We're going to try and name some of the phenomenon of people who are fighting in the midst of secularism and people who are trying to minister and evangelize in the midst of secularism. Maybe in this podcast episode, you're going to have some things clarified or some questions that you hadn't considered yet. You're going to have those raised. Maybe you're going to have some voices introduced to you that might be valuable as you seek to lead, maybe as clergy or laity in this secular age. Voices that come from other parts of the world or at other times of the church's history. I think this episode is really helpful as our leaders start to develop the disposition of deep security, both in God and what God is doing and in what God is doing in their own life. Deep security in their own spiritual life, deep security in the providence of God at this moment in time. So if you found some of the waters choppy and the leadership atmosphere dizzying and chaotic, this episode is for you. Stay tuned for a word from our sponsors and then enjoy the podcast.
We are Wesley and you belong here.
My name is Victoria Borum and I am Wesley.
I'm Lenny Lucetti and I am Wesley.
My name is Chris and guess what? I am Wesley.
Hi, I'm Tina Shappett and I am Wesley.
We recognize this beautiful diversity that the Lord has called together that is Wesley.
My name is Corey Merritt and I am Wesley.
I am Wayne Brown, and I am Wesley.
I am Colleen Durr, and I belong here. You belong here, too, because we are Wesley.
Welcome to the Wesley Seminary Podcast, Dr. Smith. It is great to have you with us.
I'm very pleased. I'm glad for this opportunity.
So you've just finished writing Wisdom from Babylon, Leadership for the Church in a Secular Age. I think the way I'd like to start is just by asking you, well, what does it mean to be in a secular age? What does secular in that context mean?
I think fundamentally it means that the social climate, the social, political, cultural climate in which we are located no longer privileges a religious voice or a religious presence. So in our case, we often use the language of secular and post-Christian together. But that's because the dominant religious expression within our culture and society was the Christian theological and intellectual tradition. And in many respects, oftentimes people speak of post-Christendom, where the church had a privileged voice. So in our context, secular means post-religious in the sense that, yes, secularity has an ideological sense to it, but primarily what we mean is we live now in a society that does not take for granted or privilege a Christian or a religious perspective, a voice, conviction, or influence.
So I want to ask two questions around that, just to maybe dig it up a little bit more. One of the things that you write and that you draw from Charles Taylor and his work, A Secular Age, is you say, it's not so much that there is secularity out there, as much as it is that we are all secular. That is, we have unwittingly drunk the water and breathed the air. Rather than Christianity maintaining a presence in secular society, secularity has infiltrated the church. That this simply is the context that we're in. I work in a seminary and we have adult students. And this is I would say, less or more true. So there are some students for whom this is less true, and there are some students for this is more true. But I would say in the university where we've got undergraduates, I would say this is more or less true, to flip it around, that it's probably more true, if not totally true, for our students coming in, that they just naturally have this as the worldview that why would I privilege a voice of faith? In part because of all the voices that they're hearing, the majority of them are non-religious or are have a religious flavor from one that is other than Christianity. Talk to us a little bit about what it means for secularism simply to be the context, the air that we're breathing, the water that we're drinking, different from an ideology, but just as the context. Talk to us about that. What does it mean for secularity to be our context?
Well, it's become our default mode in terms of our worldview and in terms of the things that we look to foster human flourishing. So the most notable, I think, is, and this again goes back to Charles Taylor, the most notable is a loss of a sense of transcendence. Mm. So our whole lives get defined in terms of only that which we can taste, touch, see, eat, and so on, our five senses, but we lose a sense of transcendence. We lose a sense of the other. We live only in this sphere of reality. And I think the secularity has its deep conviction that this is all that there is, and that gets reinforced 1,000 times over. And so you lose a sense of deferred gratification, because deferred gratification assumes transcendence, assumes other values out there that aren't necessarily fostered or appreciated or sought in the short term. So for me, probably the strongest disciple of Taylor in this score is Jamie Smith, James K.A. Smith, where he talks about the mall as the cathedral, in a sense, of the secular age. And I think what's helpful for what Jamie has done is help us to see that in many respects, some churches have become more like malls rather than trying to make the mall like a church. We've kind of bought into that consumerist sensibility, and that has become our default, and we have become secularized in that sense.
One of the things that people might be feeling is maybe they've tried to be the religious voice, or they've tried to articulate something of their Christian values, not in a way that's trying to privilege it, but just add it to the mix. They're trying to add a perspective that people might not be valuing. Maybe this is in their PTO, maybe this is in a collection of teens, maybe this is in a young adult group, you know, maybe this is just their social media presence where they try to have a religious voice that's being brought. And rather than that being respected or just added to the mixture of voices that secularism can try to create, where there's not one voice is privileged, but there's room for all voices, rather than that kind of place at the table, they actually feel a rejection. They feel a resistance to it. So there might be people that say, yeah, okay, I can see why a secular space would be good in theory, but in practice, it seems to have become its own thing. And it actually privileges non-religious voices. It privileges voices that aren't already connected with something that we might call the transcendent, or something that might exist beyond the senses that we taste, touch, see, smell, and hear, yeah. Right? What would you say to them? What would you say about secularism as an ideology in that way, that it's not just a context, but it might be something that is almost feels like an enemy or something to resist or something to overcome?
It's almost oppressive. So I will say two things in response. First, there's no doubt that there's an ideological bent, almost a crusade, maybe not the right word, but almost a commitment to dispel any kind of religious voice in the public square. And therefore, one of the things for which we do need to fight in the public square, in my estimation, is that our countries, the US and Canada, are pluralist, that the secular default is problematic. And so we need to fight for the right of the Christian or of a religious voice to be at the table. But to do so means we also need to demand the right of the Muslim voice and the Hindu voice. It's not just our voice, but we need to make a case for pluralism in the face of the hegemony. And that's the language I've used. I don't think in the book, but I use often the hegemony of secularism. So, for example, I'm the president of a university that has a distinctly Christian identity. It is a constant that I have to insist that this is a legitimate expression of post-secondary education in the province or in the country in which I do my work, that this is a legitimate. And the fact that we are Christian doesn't make us less, doesn't undermine our academic potential and credibility. that it's just the way that we happen to do it. Now, I happen to think it's the best way to do it, but I have to always insist that we have the right to be at the table, even though we have a religious identity. And there are those for whom, if you're a Christian university, you're no longer a legitimate university. That's where I express I bump up against the hegemony often. But then second, I think one of the things that the Christian community urgently needs to learn is how to build bridges. That is, how to earn the right to be heard, how to establish how to gain the political capital to be able to have voice at the table. And when our posture is one of constantly being adversarial or always being victimized, we do lose that voice. Mm. So what is it that is the means by which we can establish our voice in the public square? Why should the mayor of my city listen to me? Just because I'm a Christian? No, that's no longer going to be the case. So when I speak, I will speak as a Christian, but I need to earn the right to be heard. And I think many Christians assume, no, we have the right to be heard by virtue of the fact that we're Christian. I want to say, no, no, that's gone. Now you need to earn that right. And I think learning how to build those bridges, finding out why my Muslim neighbor on the one side and my secular neighbor on the other side, why would they want to why would they want to come over for a barbecue with me if I don't build the kinds of bridges that are essential to explore our common humanity? And for me, that's part of the genius of Bonhoeffer, but it's the genius of others who have navigated these kinds of waters, that they find the capacity to build the bridges, and then to ask the question, and N.T. Wright is brilliant at this, what are the deep yearnings and aspirations of our culture? What do they long for? What are their poets saying, for example? What are their aspirations? Ultimately, I think the Christian faith has something to respond, but we need to ask what questions are being asked or what yearnings are being highlighted. So that's the two things are one, I think we need to fight for pluralism. That is crucial to the flourishing of our countries. Secularism will ultimately destroy us on its own. We need pluralism. And then secondly, to know how to build bridges.
I think this is such an important conversation because I'm a transplanted Canadian. I live in Indiana now. And so I'm watching this. And of course, this is October the 19th that we're recording this. Pretty heightened political atmosphere at the moment, to put it lightly. And there's some ways that there's people that just speak past each other. There might be some that unknowingly, usually uncritically, but they're addressing what they feel is the air around them or the water they're swimming in. And they can feel that secularism is an ideology that can become oppressive. And so they need to fight that oppression. And yet other people can listen to them and say, why are you saying that the Christian voice is oppressed whenever you've got so much political power and cultural power in the United States right now? And here's the thing. I think both can be true, right? Yeah. Both can be true. There can be an oppressive ideology of secularism that would want to push down not just the Christian voice, but any religious voice. It just so happens that the Christian voice is most easily picked on right now, right? It's an easy pot shot, right? It's an easy pot shot because it's so strong. And that's the irony of it. Against the ideology of secularism, the Christian voice, if it's speaking only for itself, can be seen as a bully. And so it has to kind of have this way of how do we speak for the rules of the game, so to speak, that secularism should hold, which is there are no privileged voices. We all have a voice. We all have a voice at the table, and we all abide by these rules. So it can be really difficult. Some are saying this is a fight for religious freedom, and they can be right. And some can say, what in the world are you saying? It's a fight for religious freedom. You're dominating the religious landscape, right? Like you dominate the culture. So the United States is really an interesting test case with this in mind. And one of the things you go in the book is using the United States as a point of reflecting, because in its founding documents, it's trying to be a spot where religion is not endorsed by the government and it's kept as a free place, right? The culture is going to be a place where there is no religious litmus test, right? Anybody can have a voice and have a place to be free. And yet that doesn't always feel like the culture, right? That doesn't always feel like the atmosphere of the United States. And so you've got this like, well, what's the context? Is it a Christian context or is it a secular context? And it's like, man, depending on how you're using the words, depending on who you're talking to, they both are present.
Well, a number of things in response. First, I do think the train has left the station. So we can try to resist secularity all we can, but the train has left the station. There's a trajectory we're on. We're not going to be able to turn that back. And we can document why that's the case. We don't have the time for that now. My contention is that rather than fighting that, we need to leverage it. That in actual fact, the church can and will flourish in a secular age. But we need to learn how to do that. Secondly, going to Jacques Ellul, Jacques Ellul's point is, if you fight secularity with the very same tools that secularity uses, you have become more secular. That is, I think sometimes our political machinations, that's not the right word, but the political leveraging we're trying to do in the US and in Canada, especially in the province where I'm located, we try to use the very same tools in order to achieve our outcomes. So we trust in princes, to use the language of the scriptures. And we do not know how to actually leverage our political voice in a way that is congruent with our deep and core values. So many people in my world, my son, for example, is saying, clearly evangelicals don't believe in democracy because they're willing to do anything to get their will affirmed. And I'm thinking, no, we do. We believe in the political process. So you're right. We have a polarization happening in the U.S. and to a lesser degree in Canada, but in the U.S., but we all watch U.S. television and we all know that November 3rd is the date that matters to all of us more than we'd like it to here in Canada, but it does matter to us. But that polarization is deeply problematic, I think, for the country at large. It's so totally divided, but also for the church, because the capacity of the church to be a means of grace means that, to use the language of 1 Peter, we're able to give an answer for the hope that is within us. And then that next line, with reverence and grace. I cannot be viewed, I have nothing to offer you if you view me as only in an adversarial relationship with you. I've got to build the bridges. So it's hugely concerning that we are in this kind of polarized environment where we don't know how to identify how is actually secularity opening up possibilities for the church to flourish. This does not necessarily need to be inherently our enemy. But yes, I can understand when it seems like an oppressive ideology, we feel victimized by it rather than knowing how can we step back. And my point is we have good resources to step back and to say, whoa, slow down. Don't get into a victimized defensive mode. Slow down. Yes, there's a problem here, but it's a challenge. If we can readjust, readapt, and realize that now we are in a fundamentally different social cultural environment. My parents were missionaries to Ecuador, to South America. Deep within their work was you came in not in an adversarial posture to Ecuadorian culture. And they worked amongst the indigenous peoples of the Amazon. You went in and you sought to understand that culture, which was anti-Christian from the very beginning. They were anti-Christian. Of course they were. So they needed to come in and show them the love of Christ, show them and build bridges and show in actual fact, celebrate those parts of their culture that were actually indicators of the goodness and grace of God, that the Spirit had gone ahead of them. I want to say those same skills now need to happen for the church in North America, where this is now our culture. Yes, of course, it resists the gospel. Every culture does. Now let's see where's the points of resistance and where's the points of connectivity. But we have to get beyond the idea that we're always victims and we're always being threatened by secularity. I think in actual fact, we have many points of potential connection that can be a vehicle by which we actually speak to our culture, but more to the point, I want to see flourishing congregations in the midst of a secular age. And I think flourishing congregations are congregations that equip and empower God's people to be in, but not of the world, to be in business, to be in the arts, to be teaching in public schools, that all of these are ways by which Christians can be means of grace, salt and light within their community.
Joining us today is Dr. Gordon Smith. Gordon is the author of Wisdom from Babylon, Leadership for the Church in a Secular Age. Now, the title starts to give it away where you've gone to start to reflect on where we can have this wisdom. Thankfully, encountering a culture or being found in a culture that you are trying to evangelize is not unique to us in North America at this point. As you said, this is part of your own story. This has been part of the people of faith from the very beginning of God calling Abraham, right? He calls him to go to a place that's going to be not already saturated with the presence of the God of Abraham. And so this is something that Christians can draw wisdom from. Now, you've obviously, the title kind of gives it away. All right. What about the Israelites in Babylon started to give them wisdom to live this faithful and attractive way. And then you go to other places to learn. You go to Western Europe, you go to the early church, and you go to minority churches. I'd love for you just to maybe pull one or two really key insights that you had from these three sources, the early church, historic minority churches, and the church in Western Europe of the last century. What did you find in this research that you would say, if our leaders in the church could get this or could get that for today, what would that be?
There's no doubt that on the first of those, the people of Judah in exile, I'm taken by the language of Jeremiah. I think he is the primary voice. He's unrelenting that they must not bow down to the gods of their age. They have to sustain a distinctive identity. But he also then says, but seek the peace of the city to which I've sent you, plant gardens, build houses, you're present there. And you're seeking the well-being of Babylon, staggeringly, their arch enemy. You're going to seek their well-being. But he's insistent along the way, you sustain a distinctive identity. And so what that means, I think, is terribly important. Learning from the early church, there's two things I'll mention there. One is that under Ambrose of Milan, under Augustine, these are hugely important voices in my mind. They were navigating the pre-Christendom church. And one of the things that deeply impresses me is the ancient catechumenate. That is the assumption that the church is a teaching. How do you distinct? You sustain a distinctive identity by being a very intentionally teaching, learning community. And I'm using catechesis, which I know is not typical of my evangelical heritage. Anglicans and Catholics and Orthodox use that language, but I'm using it because it really is the teaching and learning that is religious instruction where you are initiated into the faith. My contention is that they would tell us we need to restore some variation on the ancient catechumenate so that the church is a teaching learning community and that evangelism and discipleship are merged in a sense. You are catechized even as you are evangelized. The other piece, of course, is Augustine's magisterial two cities. And what does it mean to live simultaneously in two cities, the city of God and the city of man? And that it's possible to do that in a way that is, there's a dynamic tension, but it's possible to seek both the well-being of both cities. And Ambrose of Milan shows us in that process that you never, ever get in bed with the president. You never, ever so affirm the emperor that you can never speak truth to power. So part of my concern is that the evangelical community in the US and Canada has been associated with a particular political party that loses its capacity then to stand apart or above to speak truth to power. But Augustine and Ambrose always insisted that you never, in a sense, co-opted your own capacity by endorsing one political entity, the emperor, so that you could always challenge the emperor and be the conscience of government. And then thirdly, I've been very taken with Japan, Pakistan, Lebanon, Turkey, where churches have flourished for centuries. In Palestine, in Lebanon, in Egypt, the church has always flourished as a minority presence. And I want to know, how did they flourish? How did the church grow? And there's no avoiding that two things. One, you can't always be in a victim mode. So you learn how to kind of get along with your Muslim, usually in Turkey, Lebanon, and Egypt, it's the dominant presence is Islam. You need to learn how to get along with these people, because if you don't, you're not going to get anything done. How to be bipartisan, how to find common ground is essential. But then secondly, there's no avoiding that they also are the persecuted church. And I think those of us in North America assume that we're never going to be persecuted, or we just don't know what persecution looks like. But where I've done most of my work in this book is actually the persecuted church in China, and how indeed the church has flourished in the midst of persecution. And I think we have some learning to do there as suburban white Christians here in North America. And I use the language white very intentionally there, because I suspect that our African-American, Black, and Indigenous brothers and sisters can tell us, well, we can teach you a thing or two about that. So it's not just the minority church. And then fourthly, I do think we have a huge voice from Central and Western Europe. That is, there's a sense in which there's not a pure trajectory from Western Europe to North America, not a pure trajectory, but there's no doubt in this book I'm writing to the church in Canada, the US, Australia, New Zealand, to some degree, Hong Kong. I mean, all of my Hong Kong associates want this book. And I said, I'm not writing for you. They say, yes, we're becoming more secular too. Okay, fine. But I wrote for them saying, those of us that are largely deeply influenced by Europe, to look at the UK, to look at France, to look at Germany, Scandinavian countries that are largely secular now and have been secular for a century, if not at least a half century, to say, what can we learn from them? And here where voices, I think they're just sheer giants of Leslie Newbegin in the UK. And he went back and forth from India to the UK. Jacques Ellul in France, a giant, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And incidentally, they're all born within 6 years of one another. So they were all trying to work this out at the same time in the 1930s and 40s. They were trying to articulate, what does it mean to be Christian in a secular age? So they're ahead of the curve. Well, what can we learn from them? Are there contemporary voices in that part of the world? Yes, Rowan Williams, Sarah Coakley, Thomas Halík in the Czech Republic, yes. But I've chosen those three voices because they're the older ones, and they don't all agree, but when I listen to them, Bonhoeffer is very important on finding common ground. Leslie Newbegin, hugely important on how to speak truth in a post-Christian secular age, in a pluralist age. So his gospel in a pluralist society should be, you know, with your Bible, you should carry it under your arm. I just think it's such an important book for Christian, for pastors, but for especially the gospel in a pluralist society. And then Jacques Ellul, do not use the tools of secularity to fight secularity. That for me is important a message as any. Three of them, by the way, they have huge political savvy. And we can learn from them on that score.
One of the shifts that I'm sensing and trying to play around with is this opportunity for people to share their story as kind of memoir. So taking important events that maybe don't look like important events until we push pause on it and look around in the whole scene and see what was God doing in the midst of that. And using social media as a place to share memoir, as a place to share the providence of God in the memory of my own life, and how that's distinct from using social media as a place to proclaim or articulate Christian teaching. Now, I think there's a place for that as well, but when I think about my social media feed, it's plugged full of people who may or may not really care about what me as a Christian has to say about what Christian teaching is. I try to articulate it. I'm trying to speak to people there who are Christians and have a sense of interest in what Christian teaching is. But I have to remember there's a whole lot of people that are just overseeing that because of the way that social media works and just the natural following that aren't interested in that. But they are interested in a sense in me and in a sense of what God has done in my life just because they are friends with me. And so I've been trying to play, well, what's the difference of witnessing to the truth of Christian doctrine and then witnessing to the truth of God in light of what he's done in my life. Now, some of the things I see you've done in the book is kind of similar. It's like done this deep dive into not just the writings, but how the writings are intersecting with people who are seeing God is still at work in our culture, even if it's got a secular feel, or even if there are secular aspects to the culture. God is still at work and we're still going to have a voice. But that way of building bridges is so often not just articulating what it is that I'm about, but is articulating, here's what God has done for me and what God has done in my life in a way that's invitational, that's gentle, that's really interesting, right? There can be a lot of beauty in memoir. I'd love to hear you kind of, as we start to wrap things up, one of the things that's necessary for me then, as I try to articulate both truth of Christian doctrine, but also the testimony, right? The function of memoir is a deep security, both in what God has done for me and is doing in my life, and the truth of Christian teaching. I've needed to find a security in both of those things. One of the things that you do in the book is to articulate the disposition of Christian leaders that's necessary in a secular age. And I think one of the dispositions that's necessary is a deep security, so that we're not consistently flustered by the events of the day or the week or the administration. And that can come from both sides of whatever political aisle or sphere one is in. Talk to us about, you know, I'd love to just toss those both of those out at you. What do you see as the role maybe of social media in a secular age? And what do you think of this notion of the strength as the security as the disposition of the leader in a secular age?
Well, let me start with the second, because I think it leads me to my comment on the first. I do agree very much that the whole phenomenon of memoir or autobiography is always been important, Augustine's Confessions, but never as important as now. It seems to me, yeah, you know, Wesley's journal, was my first reading of John Wesley. I read his other stuff because I read his journal first. I read Augustine's other stuff because I read his Confessions first. Hmm. I think we're going to recover a sense of the memoir or the autobiography, the spiritual autobiography, as a hugely important testimonial to the work of God in our own lives, and that the witness, you know, to use Wesley's language, the spirit witnesses with our spirits that we are children of God, that deep confidence that we have. But Rowan Williams suggests that the greatest threat to the church in a secular age is not external to us, but internal, and that that threat is fear. And the challenge, of course, is that we live in a culture of fear, where fear then motivates everything we do, how we vote, how we function, how we start or close a business, how we teach. Parker Palmer says higher education is pathological, the way fear shapes higher education.
Wow.
So that the only way, it seems to me, we can navigate giving leadership to the church in a secular age is not just to develop the skills or competencies that are needed for this time and in this place, but also the disposition. And the disposition is not one of fear, but of resilient hope.
Wow.
I don't have any issue that I need a Wesleyan pneumatology to sustain my capacity to be aware of, conscious of two things. One, the work of the Spirit in my own life, slow me down, cultivate the patience and hope that I need, be faithful in my own sense of my identity, and then be able to see where God is at work in my culture and society, and have the peripheral vision to realize that. And one simple illustration of that, I think, is that when I preach on what's the Spirit up to in our time, I think immigration to Canada is the work of the Spirit. That in our upbringing, we were Christian and we were evangelizing the Muslims on the far side of the world. Now God is bringing the Muslims right up the street from me. That's the external work. So you go back to Origen, the church father. He argued that we only live well when we're attentive to the inner witness of the Spirit and to the outer witness of the Spirit, and that there's a counterpoint between the two. We're aware of the Spirit's presence in our lives, and we're aware of the Spirit's presence in the world. But we can't tap into either of those because fear blocks us. The fear blocks me from being attentive to the deep inner witness of the Spirit that assures me that I'm loved and known. And the fear blinds me to what I see the Spirit is doing in my world.
It really does start to connect a theology of providence, both for the individual person, and then a theology of providence with one's nation, right? Yes. And you can see how those bounce back and forth. That, okay, if God really is doing something, and we're not going to carve a sphere and say God is doing nothing here. How silly does that sound? But sometimes it doesn't sound silly until you articulate it. Okay. lots of immigration, lots of movement of peoples, often religiously oriented and interested. If God is doing something in that movement, then what is God doing in me so that I can best act within it? Sense of security, to own what my faith is, not to be threatened by the faith that is going to be very, possibly very genuinely and deeply held by another person who now doesn't live somewhere far away, but lives right next to me. That's going to force me to ask questions of, do I believe this? Yeah. Have I oriented my life around this? Does my life bear witness to my faith in as meaningful a way as the my neighbor's life, who might be a Hindu or a Buddhist, right? Does my life as a Christian bear witness to my faith as strongly as their life in their faith bears witness to theirs? And that can be really unsettling, but it can be also the sense of like, this is what God is up to, right? Maybe God is deepening the faithful life of Christians in the West and is doing so by bringing other faiths here, right? What a gift, not just of people to live and do life with and be enriched by and to befriend and to evangelize, but also to be challenged in our own faith to get to know God in deeper ways.
Yeah, no, I don't. Well said. Just amen to all of that. I do think telling our stories is hugely important. I need to listen to the stories of others and not prejudge them.
Mm.
And what you'll find, I mean, if you listen to the story of Augustine, he went from being a pagan to a Manichaean to a Neoplatonist to being a Christian. All of that, I think, actually was the work of the Spirit. That is, the Spirit led him on that journey. So letting somebody tell their story, I'm intrigued by Alain Botain, for example, the pure secularist who insists that we need to have sacred spaces. Where is that coming from? And I'm thinking, well, tell me your story. What is it that's kind of calling to you? That's why I think poets are hugely important as well within our society. Poets are the ones that kind of articulate the angst or the longing of our society. So reading our poets, not just Christian poets, but our poets, I think is important. But yes, telling stories and whether it appears on social media. And what I wanted to say about social media was I think sometimes social media can exacerbate our fears rather than calm our fears. So yes, we need to be attentive to what's happening in the social media, but it needs to be managed in such a way that it doesn't exacerbate my fears, which is why my wife would not like me to end my day checking on the polls for the upcoming U.S. election. I think that's the last thing I should do. At the end of every day, what are the polls today for the U.S. election? And her opinion is I should be reading the Psalms. Now I'll let you decide which one's the right one for me to do.
I wonder if she would be available for a Wesley Seminary podcast because she sounds like a very wise person.
Yes, indeed.
Right on, right? What are we allowing to articulate what are we allowing to occupy our minds, especially whenever we are going into times of rest, right? We're not preparing for rest well. And I take that as a word to me. Reflecting on the words of an acquaintance, I couldn't say friend, but acquaintance I had in seminary, and he had come to faith in Christ after growing up as a Muslim. And he said, reading the Quran made him hunger and thirst for righteousness. And that desire for justice met its purpose in Jesus. Wow. And nice. he couldn't look back at his life story except as a context of God doing things. You mentioned the journey of St. Augustine and the confessions where he unfolds his journey. If listeners are maybe looking for a bit more contemporary example, I think C.S. Lewis's Surprised by Joy is another example that they're going to be able to see the journey of a person that is consistently seeing God's work in their life, in bringing them to faith. And never, it's easy for us to think about us being at the ultimate points of stories. But the truth is we always need, and what St. Augustine so nicely does, is he helps us to see us at points of middle parts of the story as well, right? There's a story that's going to outlast us. And so maybe if we look at our own moment as not the end or not a critical moment, but as a time of God sowing and as a time of God watering, as a time of God planting seeds, that can give us some humility so that not every election, not every sermon, not every event, fill in the blank, is of the most vital importance at that very moment for all of history.
Well, it's part of thinking long arc. I'm publishing a book next year on pneumatology, and I'm pressing for a recovery of the sense of the slow, gradual, incremental work of the Spirit. But we're always trying to hit home runs, if I forgive the baseball metaphor, and we probably should be more content with hitting singles. And actually, the deep work of God will happen. Runs will be scored if you advance the runner, to use an overused metaphor, but the principle I think applies to so much. I do not need to bring fire down from heaven every time I preach a sermon. I don't need to convert the nation. I don't need to be a hero or Messiah. I can just, in this time, in this place, bring the apt word and trust the Spirit to take that word for those who are present and to let it do its the Spirit's work in the Spirit's time. We need to learn patience, that's for sure.
Gordon, thanks so much for taking this time with us. We've gone a little bit beyond what the what I had said it would, and so we're gonna move to wrapping up. But I wanted to give you just a final word. We've got pastors listening in, and no doubt they are saying, yeah, growing in my own security would be really important, both as a leader and as a follower of Jesus, a leader in the church and as a follower of Jesus, including his way of living and his way of seeing the world. What would you say, as one who's talked about the Holy Spirit, who has studied the Spirit, has is publishing on the Holy Spirit, what would you say to our pastors that would be meaningful for them, especially with regard to the Holy Spirit's work in their life at this moment in time?
What I'm going to be calling for is greater intentionality around our pneumatology and a greater level of attentiveness. When the culture around us does not reinforce our religious values, perspectives, and dispositions, we can't just kind of run by inertia. There needs to be an intentionality each day to do what the Apostle Paul says at the end of the book of Galatians, to walk in the Spirit, or the great line at the end of Ephesians, to pray in the Spirit at all times and on all occasions. Mm. I think we need to cultivate a greater sense of the immediacy of the Spirit in our lives, in our preaching, in our teaching, in our relationships, and to realize that the Spirit is no less present now than the Spirit is in a earlier era. But now I think we need to not just assume that the culture is going to carry us. The inertia of the culture is not going to carry us. In fact, it's going to be the reverse. Wow. And I don't mean that in a trite way to say, Spirit, what words should I say? But I do mean it in before I go into this day to say, Lord, guide my actions, guide my words, what I say, what I don't say, but main in all of that to trust the Spirit, to do the Spirit's work in the Spirit's time. And for goodness sakes, remember that the Spirit is in no hurry. It's a long arc. It's a long arc. I don't need to be a messianic hero. I can trust. If I just do today what the Spirit has prompted me to do today, I can trust the long term.
Joining us today has been Dr. Gordon Smith. Dr. Smith is the author of Wisdom from Babylon, Leadership in the Church in the Secular Age, published by InterVarsity Press. Gordon, thanks so much for taking this time to share your insights and research and wisdom with us.
My pleasure. Very good to be in conversation with you. Very encouraging.
Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. You make these conversations possible. The Wesley Seminary Podcast aims to introduce topics and resources for fruitful ministry, and I trust we have done so today. So thanks for tuning in. Thank you, Gordon. Thank you, Cam, for your production and work. I appreciate the work that you put into making this possible. I think those final words are great for us. What is the Spirit leading us to do today? And maybe one of the things the Spirit is leading you to do is to listen to Wesley Seminary Podcast number 94 with Reverend Justin Bradbury as he talks about church planting with immigrant peoples. Thanks for tuning in. Check out that podcast if it interests you. Thanks again, Gordon, for your time, and trust you all to have a great day.
Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the name Wesley Seminary.